More informationals today. We have AAA, Larry, come on up, and John.
Well, I was going to say, Mr. Chairman, and members of the subcommittee. Anyway, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Larry Campbell representing AAA, and you are probably familiar with the fact that AAA was organized in 1905, and interestingly enough, with 550,000 members in Oregon at this point in time, one out of every five adults in the state belong to AAA. I don't know if any of you do or not, but good. See, there's our one out of five. You will be particularly pleased today because I'm not going to make the presentation. We're extremely happy that the Chief Executive Officer, President of AAA Oregon, Idaho, John Porter, is here. And John would like to take you through the informational material from AAA.
Great. Thank you, Larry. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to visit with you today. If you quickly did the math from Larry's remarks, you'll know we're having a birthday this year. We turn 100 years old. And, you know, that puts us into a handful, I'd say, of Oregon businesses that achieve the 100-year mark, and we're pleased to be among that group. The one thing that's interesting, if you go back to 1905 when we were founded, at that time we had basically two objectives, one of which remains clearly an objective today, and that is our role in public advocacy, the role to represent our members and the traveling public in general in matters of transportation safety and finance and other associated areas. So it is. We are very pleased to be here. Let me just share a few other things we do before I get into some general comments about our view of transportation issues. We, of course, as you well know, provide road service. You've probably seen someone in the public being served by one of our fleet of tow trucks or one of our we have literally hundreds of private contractors that work for us in the state. We provide a variety of insurance services, auto, home, and life. We are very prominent in the travel industry, not only in sort of a traditional travel agent role, but also in the area of publishing. The club literally, among other things in its storied past, published some of the first maps that were produced of the roadways in Oregon. We publish Via Magazine, which is our member magazine, as Larry mentioned, reaches one out of every four or five adults in the state. And we just do a lot of other things in service of our members. Our number one priority in the area of public affairs is safety. And I think our own, if you wanted to see evidence of our commitment to that, just look at what we do. We spend 24/7, 365 days a year helping stranded motorists and travelers. In our primary call facility in Lake Oswego, we will take literally nearly 2 million calls a year. And which result in about 400,000 service delivery incidents at the roadside in the state. So we are very attuned to the needs of people who are in difficult situations. I think our commitment to safety is also evident in a lot of the issues over the years we've been involved with the legislature on. Graduated driver's licenses for children come to mind, the seatbelt laws in Oregon, child passenger safety restraint laws, and speed limits and traffic law enforcement. Those are all things that over the years we've worked hand in hand with the legislature and the governor in seeing improvement in the safety of Oregonians' lives. You know, we prefer to work in this sort of a fashion. We prefer to work cooperatively with the legislature. That's, we think, the manner you can achieve the best results. There have been occasions when we have had to do other things in the fulfillment of our mission. One instance comes to mind. We did a a voter referendum in 1999. And well, I don't want to dwell on that. I would just point out AAA members tend to respond. We, in about 30 business days, were able to gather over 80,000 signatures through our offices. We have 15 offices in Oregon that provide direct services to the members in addition to some other facilities, and we employ about 400 people in the state. Some of the issues I'd like to address that we feel are important in transportation today, obviously the financial situation, transportation is paramount to all of our lives. I'm going to walk through a little of our view of transportation finance. The weight mile tax system in this state is a system that we feel very strongly is a good thing, and I want to talk a little bit about that. Talk a little bit about the gas tax, about bridge deterioration, and then lastly I'll make a couple of comments about the lawsuit that's currently in the courts in Oregon brought by the American Trucking Association against the state. If you're following along, I'm on page 5 of my handout. Let me just give you a little background about the transportation finance policy that's been traditionally used in the state of Oregon. Oregon has set a foundation, and I happen to also be responsible for the state of Idaho, and I serve on a national AAA committee that looks at public affairs, and I can honestly say of all the systems I've ever seen, I've always felt Oregon had the best system. We have a system that really is based on four key things. Number one, the user pays for the system. Motorists pay gasoline taxes. Freight haulers pay weight mile taxes. So the people actually using the system are paying for it. Those funds, and these are, let me preface, the comments I'm making right now are geared solely to state source revenue funds. Obviously, federal revenues come into the equation, but I'll talk about those a little later. The state gasoline taxes and registration fees and weight mile taxes that are received are exclusively used for roads and bridges in the state for the maintenance and construction of roads and bridges. We apply responsibility to what users of the system pay based on the costs we actually plan to spend on the system. We refer to that as a cost occasion approach. And then every 2 years, we in the state conduct what's called a cost responsibility study, where we sit down and we say how much of the tax burden should basic vehicle cars pay and how much should heavy vehicles, trucks, pay. And Oregon is unique in the country that it goes to those four steps. Now, the cost responsibility study, you'll hear this referred to as the highway cost allocation study, simply stated, looks at that assignment of costs between the two major categories of users, basic vehicles and heavy vehicles. Now, within the category of heavy vehicles, the study also looks at different weights of heavy vehicles and what allocation would be appropriate for each of them. The tax responsibility for each class is calculated. Obviously, as you might well expect, heavy vehicles tend to be responsible for costs in the construction of facilities because the facilities have to be built to their specifications. In general maintenance area, those costs tend to fall more so on cars because of just the sheer number of miles cars travel as opposed to trucks. This study is done prospectively, meaning it looks to the future. It looks at what the state plans to spend in relation to what the state plans to receive in highway revenues. This study is then provided to the governor and to the legislature. That actually is a constitutional requirement currently for their use in setting tax policy as it pertains to the highways. We have a draft of the most current study. I have the numbers. I don't know if you've been provided with the draft of the study, but the 2005 study, it appears, will make very little change to the allocation between basic and heavy vehicles. Within classes of heavy vehicles, there's a little more change anticipated, but I will leave it to the advisory committee and the department to provide that information to you, other than to say that we participate in that study. We had a representative on the advisory committee for that study and feel that it's very well done. I think it's really a good work, and I think you'll find it very helpful to you. Now, Oregon collects basically revenue from state sources in three ways. Gasoline taxes on motorists, our current gasoline tax is 24 cents a gallon in this state. That is not to be confused with the federal gas tax, which is 18.4, I believe, if I remember correctly. We collect weight mile taxes from trucks. which are based on obviously the number of miles they travel, but the rate per mile they pay is based on the weight at which their truck is operated. That's important because heavier trucks tend to damage the roadway in different ways. And the engineers could give you a better explanation of that than I could, but it's fair to say that the heavier the truck, the more extremely damaging it is, and the more resilient the roadways and bridges have to be built in order to handle the weights. The state also collects a variety of fees. You all have driver's licenses. You pay a fee for that. We all pay fees to register our cars. Trucks pay registration fees on their trucks. These funds are also constitutionally dedicated. We tend not to support their use more than is necessary, however, because they, unlike the gasoline tax or the weight mile tax, don't directly relate to a person's use of the facilities. They're more administrative in nature. Obviously, the state is also the recipient of a great deal of its funding from the federal government. And the federal government, those funds have a whole different set of restrictions placed on them depending on what kind of sources they come from. They are not, though, however, included in what is constitutionally dedicated in the state of Oregon. Now, should there come a time when the state feels it important to increase the gasoline tax that motorists pay, we have received some estimates from the department with which we concur. They look pretty close to us. Every penny of additional gasoline tax generates about $16 million a year in incremental revenue to the state highway fund. This is state gasoline tax. And when you add the equivalent weight mile tax to that, you get about $23 million a year in incremental revenue per penny. That number does erode gradually over time as fuel efficiency on cars in particular increases, but generally speaking, that is the number you'll see. Now, if I could, I'd like to make a couple of comments about the weight mile tax system. Of course, this is a tax system for taxing trucks, and the weight mile tax system in this state is used in lieu of a diesel fuel tax or some other mechanism for collecting taxes. The weight mile tax collects a per mile tax, and as I mentioned earlier, the rate depends on what weight the truck is driven. Heavier trucks pay more per mile than lighter trucks because of the damage that they do. Oregon was the first state, to our knowledge, and is currently the only state, to exclusively use the weight mile tax system to implement any sense of fairness in its taxation. We do that in this state through the cost responsibility study process. But it has been our experience that the weight mile tax system is the only mechanism we've seen that can properly distribute weights, not only between our costs, between basic and heavy vehicles, but also between classes of heavy vehicles, because not all heavy vehicles do the same rate of damage. Last session, the legislature dealt with an entirely new issue that had emerged, and that was the issue of bridge deterioration in this state. And having grown up in Tillamook County, where there are all kinds of rivers flowing into Tillamook Bay, I can tell you the need for bridges, especially in rural Oregon, but also down the I-5 corridor and moving freight and keeping our economy going. We were a supporter, and I'm pleased to say the trucking industry joined us in supporting the bill last session that authorized the state to issue bonds to begin to address a terrible bridge deterioration problem that was occurring. To date, the best information I have currently, $1.6 million of bonds have been authorized under this program. $1.3 billion for state highway bridges and $300 million for local bridges. We saw this as absolutely vital to the preservation of Oregon's economy and the ability of people to get home to their jobs. We were already beginning to see, I live in Tualatin currently, and on 99 there at the Tualatin River there's a northbound bridge and a southbound bridge. What's interesting is I would guess that the southbound bridge was built probably somewhere around 1912, somewhere in 1920, that time frame. The northbound bridge was probably built in the 50s and 60s, and it was the weight-restricted bridge. To tell you how counterintuitive this problem might seem. And we were just delighted that we could work closely with the trucking industry and the legislature in the last session to see this legislation go forward. And it's going to continue to present a challenge, but it's good to see funding available to begin to address these problems. Finally, I would like to just address the lawsuit that's currently in the courts. This lawsuit has been heard at the circuit court level and at the appeals court level, and now is before the Oregon Supreme Court. The American Trucking Association, a couple of years ago, following the voters' defeat of ballot measure 82 in the May 2000 election, filed a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of certain exemptions to the weight mile tax. This case was heard before the circuit court, and the state and AAA, we are an intervener defendant on behalf of the state in the case. We prevailed at the appeals court level. The flat fee exemption to the weight mile tax was raised as the appeals court had an issue with the circuit court's decision on that. We have appealed that decision to the Supreme Court. Rather than get into all the details of it, the exceptions to the tax are really what are at issue here. The weight mile tax itself is not being challenged as unconstitutional. It's exceptions to the weight mile tax. There are exceptions for certain commodity haulers in an effort to, I guess, streamline their record keeping or what have you. But it's important that the committee understand that the weight mile tax itself is not under attack. We are an intervener defendant in the case with the Attorney General and are working closely with them in defending the state's position. So, in summary, again, I want to thank you for having us here. We remain committed 100 years later to representing the mission. Our mission is to represent motorists and travelers in Oregon and outside of Oregon as well. We strongly support the traditions of having a user pay highway finance system with the money exclusively used on roads and bridges, where the amounts that are collected are determined using a cost-occasioned approach, arriving at a cost-responsible result where users of the system pay their fair share. We believe this creates the best result for Oregonians and for the roads and bridges on which their livelihoods and daily lives depend. And we certainly look forward to working constructively with you and the rest of the legislature and the governor in pursuing these objectives. So thank you. I'd certainly be available for any questions.
Thank you, John. Questions?
Great. Thank you very much.
I'm afraid to ask this because I've been here long enough. I should know this. When, in the cost allocation study, thank you, Mr. Chair. I apologize for not acknowledging you. But I thought it was what we had spent, not what we anticipate in the next biennium. So I'm wrong?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beyer, it's always been perspective, in other words, and that's why at the end of the period of time, there's a question as to whether or not we've shifted our money and spent it in a different way. The question you raise is something that's been raised quite often. At this point in time, though, we're still on the basis of looking at it prospectively.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you
very much.
Yeah. Jacqueline, we're ready for you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'll lead off. I'm Jacqueline Zimmer. I'm with the Oregon Association of Area Agencies on Aging and Disabilities, and I've already forgotten to turn my testimony in. I'm sorry. The panel that's with me today is a little different than the one that we talked about last week when we were meeting with your committee staff person. With me on my left is Carol Breaux, and she's the director of our Area Agency on Aging in the Bend area, and Olivia Clark, who works with TriMet. And we also had two advocates who benefit from transportation programs for seniors and people with disabilities, but as luck would have it, their volunteer driver was ill, and they were unable to attend today, which just kind of accents the value of volunteers in our system, but also the need for a permanent system in areas where you have to rely on volunteers. But we knew it was just sort of an informational-only session, so we didn't ask a whole lot of folks to come and testify today. So you'll just hear from us. But we also brought a video that I'd like Olivia to introduce to you that I think will help set the stage for our testimony.
Thanks, Jacqueline. Mr. Chairman and committee members, for the record, I'm Olivia Clark, the Government Affairs Director at TriMet. And the video, I just want to introduce it, really speaks for itself. It was actually financed by a member of the Oregon Transportation Commission, John Russell, some of you know, a developer from the Portland area, who was on an ODOT committee that handed out these senior and disabled grants, and was so overwhelmed by what he learned that he actually donated the money to make this videotape, which is really remarkable, and I think it gives you a good sense for the kinds of services that are provided around the state. So if I may, see if it works.
It's Wednesday morning in the eastern Oregon community of Halfway.
Nicole Marine, how are you today?
Where do we need to go today?
And Dave Myhill is the most popular guy in town.
D and B.
Dave is a part-time driver for Community Connection of Baker County. On Wednesdays, he transports riders on what the locals call the senior bus. It's 50 miles from Halfway to Baker City. Another 50 miles back. And each leg of the journey is an adventure.
In eastern Oregon especially, it's a long ways between communities. And in the wintertime, it's an exceptionally long ways between communities. And so that one day a week they get on the bus to come to Baker is the epitome or the zenith of their life for that week.
Baker County has for many years been one of the higher percentages of seniors in population. Right now, we're looking at about 24% of those over 60, and I think we're about 19% and have been about that for people over 65.
Most of these individuals are senior citizens, and some of them are in their 90s. We try to make it comfortable for them, and relaxed atmosphere for them, so they're not worried and they're not concerned about if they're going to make it to their appointment on time or if they're going to be left or how long they have to wait.
Hello, I'm Velma Herdlich, and I'm here 10 or so. I use the bus most of the time when I'm coming out to Baker. Mostly doctor's appointments. I have had recently doctor's appointments with my eyes, and I am gradually getting macular degeneration in my right eye, which I feel if it gets too much worse, I won't be able to drive.
In Oregon, right now, there's about 500,000 folks who are over the age of 65. We know that in the next 20 years or so, that number is going to over double. And a large portion, at least 25% of those people, cannot drive because of physical disabilities, vision, or other things. And therefore, their only way to get to a doctor's office, get to work, get to the grocery store, is via public transit.
Ready to go, Dave?
Yeah, we're ready to head out.
Curry County is another area where distances between communities are long and critical services few and far between. So residents living along Highway 101 rely on the Coastal Express, which travels 110 miles from North Bend to Brookings four times a day.
Good morning.
74-year-old Bill Dooley is a regular on the Port Orford to Brookings leg.
I commute about 64 miles each way each day that I work down here, and I work down here 5 days a week in most instances. What have we found out on that 22 unit.
Bill manages Curry Public Transit, which consists of the InterCity Coastal Express and in-town on-demand vehicles. Both services run 6 days a week, and according to Bill, demand is high.
We are almost 50% population over 60 at the present time in the Brookings Harbor area. The total in the county, I have been told, runs between 35 and 40% population over the age of 60.
See you in a little while. I rely on the Dollar Ride. They take me out to the beauty shop, then I call 2:30 to go home. And everybody knows that I ride it, so if I'm 5 minutes late or 10 minutes early, it's fine.
You got Bill, right?
I did get Bill, yes.
Our service allows them to continue to be independent far longer than they would be able to be if we were not in existence in the area. It's vitally important that these people be able to hang on, so to speak, to that independence as long as they can.
Wayne, this is exciting.
For Bob Bergman of Eugene, independence means the ability to get to work on time.
Bob is a pretty miraculous young man for the difficulties that he has, I think. He's now 55 years old, so we have gone through 55 years of dealing with differences. Because he was a preemie, he had the cerebral palsy. And did take him in for physicals, of course, and was referred to an ophthalmologist. And I suppose that that was a very landmarking day, the day that I was told he was blind hard.
Today, Bob works at Oregon Research Institute. It's a job he loves and a job that benefits his community.
We've seen a transformation of Bob that's just been unbelievable. He likes to have fun. He likes to do a lot of things. And the Lane Transit District's opportunity of riding the bus has allowed him to do that.
They want to be meaningful and productive members of society. So without these services, it would be a sad day for the state of Oregon and a sad day for a number of residents.
If I didn't have the city bus, I'd be stuck at home.
Doing what?
Oh, just playing with my CB radios.
It's all a big pie where you cut it into, you know, living, working, and social. And it takes transportation to do every single one of them.
I think you'll realize very quickly that, you know, a number of people in your immediate family probably need that type of assistance. Where family members and friends are unable to provide that service, that's where the public transit division and our program step up to try to help.
The main source of funds that's available for community transportation services are federal funds, which we can flex out of the highway appropriations, and those funds primarily are used for equipment acquisitions. We flex as much as we can. We work with the local districts to maximize our ability to stretch those funds as far as possible, but we never have enough.
It's more than tires, gasoline, a vehicle. It's a social support system that is just critical.
It just opens doors that we never would have imagined. And if we can make that happen for folks, all folks, not just folks with disabilities, then it will be a much better community.
It's good stuff.
Thanks, Olivia. That was excellent. Okay, you can proceed.
Well, that test or the video is really spot on, I think, in describing the need for services around Oregon. And I just have a few comments to add to that. And I think if you heard one of the speakers, they talk about the population of aging in Oregon or the aging population. And I I think that we also have to add to that the population of people with disabilities in Oregon, which is a growing population as well, and not just people with developmental disabilities, but people with physical disabilities, and a number of whom are still very productive individuals if given the opportunity. So I'd just like to put that in there as well. So of the 50 states featured in the 2000 census, Oregon had the 10th highest percentage of people aged 65 and older, and we're projected to have the third highest number of elderly people in the nation by 2040. So this is just where this is the warm-up to what's coming down the path here. And I think in the film they mentioned that we don't really know how many people will need transit service, but we do know that a quarter of the people that are over 75 years of age do not drive, and that the majority of the people that receive long-term care services in Oregon from our system live out in the community. We have the same number of people in nursing homes today that we did 20 years ago. So people that live in the community really depend upon public transit for some of their services. And door-to-door service is really, I think, the best that you can get. There was a survey that was done a number of years ago that asked people if they would be willing to take public transit if it was located a couple of blocks away. And the sweetest responses came from sort of the old, who said, I certainly would. If you could just put a bench halfway for me to rest at, then I could certainly get the rest of the way, and that's the person that needs door-to-door service, yet they're still willing to put some effort out and to try to get to the stop. So, but the door-to-door, door-through-door service really is so valuable. I was just going to mention some of the types of rides that are provided, and they talked about it on there. So the medical rides, there's life-sustaining medical rides, so there are a number of people who rely upon it for chemo and dialysis. Personal business, you still have personal business to attend to. Shopping, nutrition, so to meal sites. Volunteer or paid work, we have a high number of volunteers among the retired community in Oregon. And training, and then recreation or social gatherings, which are very important. And they talked a little bit about funding in the video. We do have, you'll hear the acronym STF being floated around the Capitol if you're new to the building, Special Transportation Fund for Seniors and People with Disabilities, and that comes from a cigarette tax. And then last session we got lucky when someone discovered that there was a little bit of extra money in the ID fund. So if you go to the Department of Motor Vehicles to get a driver or to get an ID instead of a driver's license, there happened to be a little of extra money in there, and some of that was diverted to programs for seniors and people with disabilities who needed transportation. So that was a nice boost to the fund. But the cigarette tax funding of it, as the harder we work to discourage people from smoking, the less money there is in that particular fund. So we have to keep that in mind. And I don't really want to go through all the rest of the statistics that I have in here for you. It's in your testimony. But a couple things to keep in mind is that funding for senior and disabled transportation services is relatively flat. And, of course, the cost of gas has gone up very much, as has the cost for personnel. So that's impacting our system. And then the governor, in his recommended budget, has put a cap on how many seniors and people with disabilities can receive long-term care services, and he has capped it at about 21,500 people. We have over 30,000 people using our system today, and a number who have lost services in the last couple of sessions. So that puts a tremendous amount of pressure on other public transit services to kind of pick up the difference for folks that still need transportation. Most of our providers are at capacity, and in a lot of areas there is no evening and no weekend service or no Sunday service. Right here in Salem, there is no Sunday service. So, and then just for fun, one of my directors from the LeGrand area wanted you to know that one day per week, the bus from halfway goes into Baker City, and if the riders are nice, they get a ride home, and if not, they have to stay in Baker City. So that was they wanted to know that we were still paying attention here at this point in the testimony, so they included that to see if they could catch me. Anyway, a couple of fun statistics. In Clackamas County, the number of rides provided using STF funds last year were almost 75,000 rides. In LeGrand and Baker City and Wallawa and Enterprise, Elgin, and those areas, there were 53,480 one-way trips, and 51% of the riders were seniors, 14% were people with disabilities, and 35% were the general public. And they're also denying passengers and rides today due to lack of space. And then I think Lane County, just for fun, I threw this in, they provided 617,729 miles of rides in 1999 to 2000. So we're very busy in this particular program, and we just wanted to make you aware that it existed and that if you have questions about it, you can let us know. I'll move on.
Okay. Well, I'd just like to share a couple of things with you that brings it home to the smaller counties, or not smaller in size, but smaller in population. If you look at Clackamas County versus Baker County, you can see that Baker County's done almost as many rides as Clackamas County. And that's because in Baker County, there's no public transportation to make up the difference for those folks who can get to the public transportation. The burden of transportation services in the rural areas really does fall on the Area Agency on Aging. We are not equipped or educated to provide transportation services, but there are no other services in Central Oregon where I am the director. So we do all the transportation services. As city and county budgets get cut, their funding to us is reduced because community partners are the first ones that get the reduction in funding. So as our population goes up and our funding goes down, we are still the only ones that provide the dial-a-ride transportation or any kind of public transportation in the tri-county area of Deschutes, Jefferson, and Crook County. Another thing is, and as much as we believe that it's important for the mandatory reporting that's now happening with doctors having to report to DMV when a senior has an issue, it also causes a huge impact on our programs as people lose their driver's license, they become devastated. We not only have to deal with the devastation of what's happened to them, but we have to find a way to get them to the doctors and to the medical appointments that they need. And I think the other thing is, in Central Oregon, we have done a lot of studying on what causes depression and what is going on with our seniors. And the number one cause of depression is isolation. Isolation and depression are the things that lead to the downward spiral of both physical health and mental health. And if we can keep these folks from being isolated and keep them out in the community, we're ahead of the game.
Thank you for your comments. For the record, could you identify
yourself? I'm Carol Breaux, the Director of Central Oregon Council on Aging in Deschutes County.
Thank you. Questions? Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You made the case, at least to some degree, about the gap between need and services, and it looks like with the governor's budget and then with the projections of the number of elderly and disabled in the future, that gap's going to widen even further. Do you have a couple statistics in here. Do you have a broader look at the state that talks about that difference between current need and or projected need and where the services actually are now? They've broken down by county or region or however it may be available.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hunt, there is more thorough information available that we can bring to you. And since we were just doing information only 15 minutes, we kept it brief, but we'll certainly get that to the committee.
Mr. Chairman, if I can just say something about this. This is Olivia Clark from TriMet. We know that we're going to be hit by a huge demographic wave. And I think what we're trying to do at TriMet is what you heard last week. You heard about the productivity improvement program. We're actually trying to apply that to accessibility as well. And we have a group working on that with a three-pronged strategy, knowing that we want to surf that wave and not be blown away by it. We've got three different efforts going on to try to extend the resources that we have and meet the demand. If I can, for a moment, may I speak to that just for a minute about what we're actually trying to do? First of all, if you saw the handout I provided you, there's probably 9 million rides per year on our regular fixed route system that are elderly and disabled folks, and we're approaching about 1 million on our Lyft service. The first thing we're trying to do is to improve the fixed route service so that more elderly and people with disabilities will use fixed route. That's the first thing we're trying to do. That means sidewalks. That means lighting. That means people feeling safe. life to try to encourage that. The second thing is to look for options in the metropolitan area anyway between the Lyft service, which is a rather extensive door-to-door service, and fixed route, whether that's neighborhood shuttles. We just started one in the northeast part of Portland with the African American Chamber of Commerce, with Elders in Action and others, to try to get a route down so that people won't call for a Lyft ride and won't get on the big fixed route, but will have something in their neighborhood that takes them to all those places that Jacqueline talked about. And third, we're looking at trying to bring together in the metropolitan area all those service providers to do training for social workers and others, and to try to tailor services to the needs that exist, to actually provide rider training to get more people on fixed route. So there are a variety of strategies we're trying to address in the metropolitan area to meet that growing demand and try to get a handle on the costs that are going to be coming as well.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you very
much. Appreciate the information. And now, Metro.
Came on. In the future, PowerPoint will always work. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Rex Burkholder. I'm Metro Councilor from District 5, which, if you just think, the northern half of the city of Portland, downtown, northwest, north, and northeast Portland. I'm also chair of the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation that we fondly call JPACT, and that's the reason I'm here today. That's the group of elected officials that help the Metro Council make decisions on transportation policy in the metropolitan region. Thanks very much for the opportunity to come down here today to testify before the committee on the subject that I think is of great importance both to our metropolitan area as well as the citizens of the rest of the state. And I want to leave four basic messages with you. One is that the metro region is continuing to grow rapidly, even with the recession, at a pace faster than the nation as a whole. That growth is putting some major stresses on our entire transportation system. The failure to continually make improvements to the entire transportation system will have significant impacts on the movements of freight and people, and that finally, investing in transportation will have a positive impact on the economic recovery for the state and the metro region. I do have some slides here to talk a little bit about what metro is, what we do, and why we're doing that, and then go on to the transportation issue. Okay, good. I just want to make sure we're matching here with these slides. Okay. As you know, Metro is a directly elected regional government. There's six councilors elected from districts like myself, about 250,000 citizens in each of those districts, and we have an elected regional president who oversees the operation of the Metro Council. The primary purpose for Metro, as it was formed, was planning for growth, both on the areas of transportation as well as land use. And then we have some additional responsibilities that are listed there. These are issues of regional concern that it's been thought that it's easier to deal with those on a large basis. And there are issues, as you can see, like air quality and solid waste disposal, which are not really boundary dependent. And they're more efficiently dealt with on the regional scale. Specifically, the Joint Policy Advisory Committee on Transportation is I call it the big table. It's one of two big tables we have. This one deals with transportation. We have another one that deals with growth management issues, where the elected officials from throughout the region come together at Metro, and we debate, how do we deal with these issues that are facing us? How do we deal with limited resources and the issues of growth in an effective way so that everyone benefits and everyone pays similar costs for that? Metro has the responsibility to develop these transportation plans and policies for the region, and we do it, as I said, in a collaborative manner with our local governments. This gives you an idea of the makeup of JPACT, which includes both elected officials and then agency heads from state departments, as well as the city of Portland, and then representatives from the north of the Columbia River, because because about one quarter of the population of the metro area lives in across the river in Washington. There are some representatives there, and we have representatives that also sit on their similar organization over there. This has led to one of the this kind of collaboration has led to a lot of success in us being able to get more than our share of federal dollars dedicated to the metropolitan area to deal with transportation issues. Metro is also, under federal law, what they call a metropolitan planning organization. There's actually a number of these in the state, but the roles of MPOs, as we another acronym, we actually have a, I just hired a new assistant, and she has a like 5 or 6 page pamphlet that's just acronyms and transportation alone, and we have other things we do. And one of the purposes of a metropolitan planning organization, in addition to doing the planning for the region, is to receive and distribute a share of the federal transportation dollars that come to the state. And we do this through the JPAC process. We're in the midst of that right now. And we also have responsibility for ensuring that the region meets federal air quality requirements. As I mentioned, there's 6 metropolitan planning organizations in Oregon. We are the largest, but there's also Salem-Keizer and Eugene-Springfield are in the same category of with a population of over 200,000. And then we have the Rogue Valley, which is in the Medford area, Bend, and Corvallis, which is Lane-Benton County area. And that's about 58% of the population of the state lives just in those 6 metropolitan areas. There's a couple other things I should mention about some coalitions that we work with. One is a bi-state coordination committee, which was originally a subcommittee of JPAC, and then recently because of the I-5 trade corridor partnership study, I believe that's what it was called, one of the recommendations was that there should be a bi-state group that's set up that also deals with issues of land use as it relates to transportation. It's a forum for discussion. There's no legal responsibilities or authority there, but it's a place where we can talk to our compatriots from across the Columbia River and deal with those issues that relate to both sides there. And the other one is a beginning group that's called the West Coast Corridor Coalition, which is a 4-state group, California, Oregon, Washington, and then Alaska, to talk about trade movement within the I-5 corridor and up and down the Pacific coast, and to basically go and lobby the federal government for a higher priority for that very important trade and transportation lifeline there. Over the years, we've done a lot of work with our citizens in terms of looking at the long-range plan for the region, and we've surveyed them and had their comments during many public meetings and also through a number of elections that found out about what they cared about. What do the people care about? And I'm not going to read it to you there, but these are the basic goals that people have and hopes they have for the region are these types of issues there. And a key piece that relates to transportation is really the economy. And the Metropolitan Plan, which we call Region 2040, it was a 50-year plan adopted in the 1990s. And also the Regional Transportation Plan that came out of that is really focusing on how do you maintain a good place to live, and the economy is an important piece of that. And obviously transportation is important to the economy. As I mentioned at the very beginning, growth is continuing to occur. It's one of these surprising things that people, because of the quality of life we have here in Oregon, are continuing to move here at a rate about twice the national average of growth is what's going on here. So we have a growing population that we have to deal with, have to provide for them, transportation being one piece of that. And the fact is that even we have to plan for this even if the money's not increasing as it comes in. We just have more people here we have to deal with. There's also a relationship with the neighboring communities. Obviously, the growth of this kind of level in the Portland metropolitan area puts a lot of stress on both our community, on the farmland, which is the urban growth boundary, which is one of our duties, is to oversee the urban growth boundary, as well as neighboring communities, the cities of Canby, Sandby, Estacada. Those are areas that we have a lot of relationship with, and this is why. Because you end up, because the jobs that are coming to the metropolitan area and the number of jobs there, and the fact that housing is getting more expensive because of the demand for the housing, you get many more people commuting into smaller communities. The growth is going on, especially in Clark County, but also in Yamhill, Marion County, and then outside our jurisdiction in parts of Washington and Clackamas counties. And this commute puts a lot of pressure on our system. you have here, it's I'm going to point out a couple interesting pieces on this. It's, we have two maps, one in the, from 1993 and then another one from 2000. And the change is, it may seem slight, but if you
go back and forth a little bit.
Go back and forth. We're not trying to mesmerize you or anything, but just to show you that there's some of these dots that have changed considerably. And these dots represent traffic counts we got from the Oregon Department of Transportation. For example, on the I-205 corridor, the traffic counts have gone from 90,000 cars a day on the I-205 bridge to 136,000 cars a day in just 10 years. And that's about 50% increase. And if you go out towards Sandy, they've gone from 19,000 between Sandy and the metropolitan area to 31,000 today. You know, almost a doubling. It's about 75% increase. And just one other is Highway 26 west of Hillsboro. It's gone from 23,000 to 36,000. So we're seeing a lot of growth happening outside the metropolitan area. And that has, obviously, when it hits the region, you get a lot of problems with transportation just backing up even before you get into the metropolitan area. Well, how we deal with this, okay? Here's our plan, because you have to have a plan to deal with the problem. And what we have is the Regional Transportation Plan. As I said, it comes out of the Region 2040, which set those goals that I mentioned there. And it tries to respond both to this growth and change and economic desire for economic development, as well as the people's desires. And I'll go into a little bit about what's in this plan. The plan has six different systems laid out on the in the area. That's all the different modes of transportation, from bicycle to highway to freight. And it looks at how do you make sure that your population centers have good access to them and your industrial areas have good access to them, and that there's choices for people so that they don't have to get in their car in order to move around the region to access a job or to go shopping or to go for recreation. And this next chart shows a pie chart of what type of projects are in our priority list. And you can see it's a very broad distribution of projects. About 50% is road, 41% is transit, which bulk of that is capital expenditure for building the light rail system up and not in the operation. And about 3% there for bicycle and pedestrian, which is usually adding a sidewalk here or there or striping a bike lane on a road. So as you can see, it's an ambitious plan, and it is also trying to be comprehensive.
Thank you. Am I correct in understanding that that doesn't include any maintenance and press? That's just additional capacity?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Hunt, yes, this is, quote, modernization or improvements to increase capacity in each of these. It's not preservation and modernization.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Good question. Well, growth, as we said, is that we know it's coming. We're not we don't advertise in Philadelphia and Detroit to get people to move here, but they do move here. So, and when you get to population growing, increased rates of vehicle use, which we've seen especially with the women entering the workforce and the creation and households being smaller, you tend to have more vehicles being used, as well as the fact that freight movement is expected to double in the next 15 years, and you probably heard this story before, and Port of Portland being one of the major ports for moving containers and cars and other things through, we have a problem on our roadways because they're not growing. And we have our plan, but one of the key issues. Oh, no, let me, one more. To the next one. Yes, please. And here's what we predict, not what we want to see happen, but this is what we predict to happen if we cannot fund that plan. And just again, some of the consequences are is that our average vehicle speed will drop about a quarter on the major roadways. Travel time will go up about a quarter. Your congested freeway mileage will be 150% more of those, and your congested arterials, which many people use as an alternative freeway, will get congested even at a higher level. In the metropolitan area, the freeways are, of course, an important component, but arterials are just as important for moving freight and people around in our metropolitan area. And this ends up being that people, let's just say, they'll be stuck in the traffic a lot more. And so that's the challenge we have, that if we can't fund our transportation plan, this is what we see as the future coming towards us. And that will have some huge impacts on business. And some of them are very direct. Do you have to hire another truck driver and buy another truck in order to make the same number of deliveries in a day that you did 10 years ago? And these add up in terms of impact on the economy. So The issue is, as you have, will probably hear today and many other days, is that there's a disconnect between the amount of dollars that we have coming in for maintaining and building the system and the need based on growth and based on inflation impact on those dollars. One of the issues is inflation and fuel efficiency. The equivalent, if you look at the purchasing power of our gas tax, it's dropped by over half in terms of its value. Another way of looking at this, I think it was an ODOT committee meeting, it was mentioned that the 24 cents that was established in 1991, the last time the gas tax was increased, it has a purchasing power equal to about 11 cents of 1991 dollars. So the majority of the gas tax funds are going to maintenance and preservation right now. The system that we have and keeping it from falling apart is the main use of those dollars. So how do you add more capacity or add more, do improvements if you don't, if you're spending all your money on maintenance and preservation? And here's a key slide, kind of, I guess, a reminder, maybe a little bolster to your courage here in this coming year, is that when you look at similar states, and this is just the West Coast states, but it's actually the fact across the country, is that we have some of the lowest fees on automobile use in the country, and certainly on the West Coast. You can see we're about one-third of California's and Washington's, and then it goes down from there. But even Montana, we have just a little under half in terms of combined fees and gas taxes in terms of collection. You can see that gas taxes, which is the bottom color of the bar, is about the same. They vary just a tiny bit. But you have sales taxes on vehicles, which is the dark bar in the middle on in most states, and then other vehicle taxes that are collected in these other states. So if we had that kind of money, we wouldn't be here today, right?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
You made a comment about you were comparing some things, and I guess I missed the part. Was it a time frame? You said women entering the workforce from point
yes.
something to point something?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Boone. Yes, in the last 20, 30 years, in terms of vehicle use and the number of cars that are on the road, you've had demographic change, and one of those being women entering the workforce. And therefore, 1950s, when I was young, my mom stayed at home, my dad had the car, and went to work. And now that's many families. Both members of the family are working, and so you have to have an extra vehicle, and they're both out on the road. Is that what you're asking?
So you were basically from 1980-something? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. My expert here is nodding his head. So, but, you know, one of those there's many demographic changes.
Some of us
have
been working longer than that. Driving longer than that.
Well, yeah, maybe it's the other person went to work. But, there are more vehicles on the road is the point right now, relative to the number of people is the issue. This last chart, which is talking about, again, we're going back to the plan. When we said the priority system, which we had that pie chart of all those different projects we'd like to be able to build in the next 20 years, but that bill, the current dollars, we figured that's going to be about $7.5 billion worth of projects in the next 20 years. What we have, what we predict we're going to get in terms of the dollars based on what we think the federal government's spending every year and that type of thing, is about $3 billion. So we have a $4 billion shortfall just in the metropolitan area alone if we want to maintain the current level of service we have on our roads, freight moving, people moving, those types of things. We need in the metropolitan area a considerable more amount of money. So about $4.4 billion over the next 20 years is what we need to collect more. From all sources. That would be federal, state, and local taxes. So what we have prepared, and we have unanimously adopted by the Joint Policy Advisory Committee of Transportation as well as the Metro Council, is a package that we're bringing to you, which you have a resolution in front of you, which is in general just stating what the need is that we're looking at, and it includes three components. One is a road infrastructure package, which is both for modernization and preservation, and the potential sources for these dollars could be increases in title fees, indexing the gas tax, raising the gas tax, and also the registration fee, which, for example, is still about the 46th, is number 46 in the country in terms of how much we charge for registration. There's also a non-road package in here, which incorporates the Connect Oregon package, which the governor included in his budget. But we also would like to see funding for the next leg of the light rail system that we're building in the Portland metropolitan area. We have currently, there's a $10 million a year lottery allocation that pays off the bonds on the West Side Light Rail that expires in 2009, I believe, and we'd like to have that dedicated for the next leg of the Milwaukee, from downtown Portland to Milwaukee light rail line. And then finally, a third component is transportation demand. Our current programs already being funded, which we'd like to have continued. One is transportation demand management program to encourage people to use alternative modes, as well as bus replacement and funding for elderly and disabled transportation. And finally, the economic benefits of investing in our transportation system, we know, because over the years, our governments have invested in transportation, and we've seen that we've gotten the economic development in terms of new jobs, improved access for people to be able to get to what they need and get what they want, an overall benefit to the economic climate just in that with that gives you there, especially with the investing of the port and importation of goods. And then just finally, that other states are investing billions of dollars, especially in their freight systems, to make sure that freight keeps moving. Los Angeles area is putting in a whole new highway and rail corridor from its port to get materials through that area in a way that it's not blocked by congestion, as one example. And Portland, or the Portland area, which helps the whole Oregon, all of Oregon, be economically competitive, is actually at a slight disadvantage. It's a small port, kind of out of the way, up a long river. It's really critical for us that we maintain that, and looking at economic competitiveness, especially competing with the Seattle-Tacoma area, it's very important that we deal with those kind of issues of rail congestion and road congestion in order to deal with that. So that's the end of my presentation, and I appreciate your patience and your willingness to listen to me, and I'm here to answer any questions you might have.
Yes. One question. And when you were talking about congestion and miles of congestion on roads, was that was there any comparison from different times of day, or was just this an overall study of congestion in general, right, or what was that?
Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Thatcher, it's an overall study in terms of number of hours of increased amount of time that you would spend. And you add a minute for 10,000 people driving across a bridge, for example, another minute a day, that adds up to your number of hours that you have. And it's typically in the peak hours, I believe. It's in your peak hours of congestion. So what we're finding right now is that what used to be the rush hour mm-hmm. is now the rush 4 hours, mm-hmm. where the two middle hours are really tough, and then you still are getting the shoulders of that bulge are starting to spread out. Mm-hmm. Now the important thing for that is not like it stops traffic, but what happens is that the freight movement, especially, it's now there's a number more hours a day where the freight or the trucks are slowed down enough to actually have an economic impact. And so congestion is measured by how much time in the peak hour. Because actually, when you look at the number of hours a day that the road is empty, it is empty quite a bit of the day, but that's between like midnight and 6 in the morning. It's empty, but during the time when people need to move around, that's when we're seeing the troubles.
Okay. Other questions? I just want to commend you all for pushing us out of our comfort zones and not letting us wait until we get to the place where we're California or some other state and we're so far behind that we can never catch up again. But one thing you didn't touch upon, I'd be interested in whether Metro and or JPAC have taken a position on this. The Oregon Transportation Commission has identified several projects of statewide significance, some of which are in the metro area, some of which obviously are not. Do you generally, in terms of looking at projects overall in terms of future modernization needs, has JPAC or the Metro Council affirmed that set of projects, maybe affirm the whole list or just affirm the list of those in the metro area?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative Hunt. Yeah, it's in the metro area, yes. We actually are required in the federal rules as the Metropolitan Plan Organization to integrate all the state projects into our regional transportation plan, and then we kind of, in a way, co-adopt the state transportation improvement program in our region as well as our Metropolitan Transportation Improvement Program. So they are in our plan, and we work very closely with them. I think some of the key issues are, just for example, these large projects that are almost $500 million or up to $1 billion or maybe more in the case of the Columbia River replacement of that bridge. We don't know how we're going to pay for them. We have the I-599W connector south of Sherwood. We have the Sunrise Corridor in Clackamas County. We have Highway 217. We just completed a corridor study, and it's about $400 million to add another lane to that. And then we have the bridge, which we have no idea what that means. But we don't know how we're going to fund any of those. And the question is, you have problems today, and what can you do today to alleviate some of those problems in those areas in the absence of the big fix. We don't feel very confident that the federal government is going to step in on many of these issues that will be partners in there, but we still have to come up with quite a bit of dollars on the state level and the local level to be able to do these. But we do coordinate very closely with those, and the OTC, well, three or four of the statewide significance projects are actually in the metro region, which is it's good, but we're still looking for the dollars and trying to find those.
I noticed the commission just approved some partnerships and possibility of tolls. You don't really address that, or I missed it. Is that a consideration?
As a potential source of revenue?
Yes.
Yes, Mr. Chair. The tolls have been talked about, and there was actually a few years ago a congestion relief study that was done under a federal pilot program that Metro did, and it looked at the issue of using, well, they call it congestion pricing. Tolling is another word for that. And that actually the results were actually very promising. It was a good revenue source. You actually reduced congestion. And one of the major issues was, at the time, it was politically infeasible. And the recommendation was on new facilities or new capacity, you could consider that. On the Highway 217 study that I just referenced, it was amazingly popular, the idea of having a toll lane added to the facility. People were very understanding the idea that money's tight, we want to build something more, and people are willing to pay a bit more. Now, in the case of the Columbia River crossing, there's been some work done by some consultants for ODOT that have shown that tolling is actually very feasible and is a very good source of revenue. In the case there, you toll probably both bridges, the 205 as well as the I-5, in order to make sure people just don't shift their bridge should they travel across. But the fact there, you kind of have a captive audience. If they want to cross the river, they have to pay. So it makes it a little easier in a situation like that. Tolling, again, is something I don't think we've put into our as expected revenue. It is a potential source of revenue, but it's a political issue in terms of where's the first one and who takes the arrows for that.
And we do have a requirement for tolling.
Oh, and I was just reminded that we do have a requirement that on all new facilities, we do look at tolling to see what it can provide in terms of revenue for that as well.
Other questions? Thank you very much.
Well, thanks very much again.
Bicycle transportation, Scott.
Thank you, Chair Gilman, members of the committee. My name is Scott Bricker, and I actually represent two interests today, the Bicycle Transportation Alliance and the Willamette Pedestrian Coalition. So I'm dealing with walking and biking folks, generally short trips, but important trips. So I'll try and keep my presentation as short and as important as possible. I appreciate the opportunity to lay out some opportunity for overview of our issues today. I've met with most members of the committee and will meet with all members about some specific legislation we're working on, but want to have the opportunity to paint the picture. And when I was in graduate school for transportation planning, I worked a lot with middle school kids and tried to teach them about transportation planning, and I thought being a biking and walking folk and sort of a minority transportation population, I could paint you my picture at least of today and perhaps tomorrow's trip. Today I woke up in the condo that I'm renting and took the elevator to my car and decided to drive to Salem from downtown Portland. Drove down here and battled a little bit of traffic and also had the choice of whether I park and walk about a half mile or pay the $6. And since I was running a little bit late to Representative Bruin's office, I decided to pay the $6 and park near the Capitol. On my way up, I sort of walked and took a hop skip up the Capitol steps and was up on the House wing and decided to get a little bit more exercise and run up the three flights of stairs instead of take the elevator to the office to my 8 o'clock meeting. And then later, in trying to prepare for this presentation, I went over to Willamette University and decided to jaywalk instead of walk halfway down the block to the crosswalk that's marked in a strange and odd location, but decided to jaywalk across the street and go to Willamette University and walk over there and walk back. So as you can see, I had a number of choices today, and I chose some things and didn't choose others. And tomorrow I'll have another set of choices as I stay in downtown Portland instead of coming come here and will choose to either bike or walk to my work and potentially take a transit trip or two and maybe walk to lunch or get my coffee. And I think folks around our state have those types of choices every day, although some folks, depending on where they live, may not have all those choices. Let's see here. I'm interested in talking about the importance and the role of walking and bicycling as a piece of transportation, as an important link of the trip. And I think when we heard from the senior and disabled transit folks, an important link that they faced every time was walking the two blocks to the transit stop, was when they were picked up and dropped off by the bus or paratransit vehicle. However, they had to walk between their beauty parlor and their doctor's appointment. And that's a really important aspect of the trip. And there's some statistics I have for you. And I provided a couple of handouts that will hopefully be useful. And the handout that starts with the role of bicycling, walking, and transportation, I tried to lay out 6 points that I thought you'd find valuable for the role of bicycling, walking, and transportation. And these are really the points that I think most people are addressing here. However, dealing with bicycling and walking, not having a large formal constituency, and actually both of the organizations I represent were formed in 1991, so we've been around for 14 years. I hope when we reach our 100th birthday, we'll also have 500 or 800,000 members. We'll see if we can get there. I think AAA has done a great job that way in representing folks, and we'd like to do the same. The movement of people and goods is the first point I'd like to address. I also handed you a couple of other things, but one is an article, is why traffic congestion is here to stay, and that's part of a journal that we receive. And if you don't get this journal, it's called Access. It's out of the University of Berkeley, and it's actually an excellent transportation journal. It deals with all types of issues. It's not an alternative mode journal. It's just a smart PhD journal, and it's free, so yeah, consider picking that up or ordering it. Folks, I believe that while the transportation network, obviously we're trying to move people and move goods, bicycling and walking, maybe we're not dealing with the movement of goods per se, but we are talking about an important aspect of vehicle trips, and we're also talking about different places along the vehicle network. There is a problem today with gridlock and traffic problems, and as this article talks about, there may not really be a solution to those issues, especially with some of the statistics we've seen, vehicle trips increasing, especially in the primary networks. So when we look at some of the costs that are associated with it, there are other aspects as well. For example, car parking spaces. A car parking space costs between $12,000 and $24,000 a space, depending on if it's a structured parking or a flat parking structure. I mean, a surface lot. And I actually, my second handout, which is the picture of the large buildings in the city of Portland, is a representation of what the city of Portland estimated parking they would have to provide if everyone who commuted to work drove. About 40% of people in downtown Portland don't drive or don't take single occupancy trip. And clearly it's an important aspect when you look at land use, when you look at how to get as many people as possible into an area. And I think that communities all around Oregon face some of the same decisions. Walking and biking can actually bolster the economy, which is something that is not really talked about. I think clearly moving freight and other goods is an important part of the economy. However, when you look at some of the town centers, the main streets, community centers, not just downtown, but when you look at small cities like Lake Oswego, they've revitalized their downtown. Clearly, Portland has done it, but also so have other communities such as Astoria, downtown Bend, places such as Joseph that have actually had wonderful main street projects that have brought people there for tourism, and other places along the coast, places such as Hood River, Ashland, Sisters. There's a host of communities that have chosen to revitalize and reconnect their downtown so people can walk and bike around those places, so they can, even if they drive there, they have the opportunity to go between businesses as opposed to have to get into their car each time. And I think that's a really important aspect when you look at transportation funding. So far we've spent a lot of resources on clearly on transportation packages for freight, and that's important. And right now, I really applaud the multimodal freight interest because I think that has the potential of relieving some congestion. And hopefully in the future, we could look at some other types of transportation funding for the revitalization of small downtowns around Oregon. There is a strong return on investment, and while I've been looking for research on this, it's hard to find. However, I have some good examples. For example, in the city of Portland, again, I know Portland better than most. There was the Lovejoy Ramp, which is a bridge, a ramp on the Broadway Bridge, was removed, and it was a $20 million project. It was removed, and $1 billion of transportation investment had subsequently of new development had opened up north of that ramp. In addition, the North Macadam area of Portland is another area that's being redeveloped in sort of a multimodal transportation network, and the city of Portland is calling that their largest economic development project ever. The city of Portland and Portland Development Commission have some good examples of innovative financing, and I would hope in the future that transportation committees can work with economic development committees to actually leverage resources and improve, link transportation investments to small business support and redevelopment support. And that's something that's gone on in the city of Portland. It's helped actually, it's helped bring in new small businesses, have people reinvest in their properties, increase property values in the surrounding area, thus investing more contracted labor and other things. And this really local type jobs, I think it's a connection that is overlooked. And I think I might be the only person out there talking about it. I hope in the future, again, 100 years down the road, I have a coalition that includes small businesses and small downtowns and small community development agencies that see the importance of where to spend their transportation funds. And I think a community, there are some communities in here that around Oregon that are looking at those issues right now. I spent a month on the Oregon coast, and Tillamook, I think, is looking at that type of an issue. They have a highway, state highway running right through their town, and they could either try and put more traffic at higher speed through that, or they could try and slow it down and redevelop their downtown. I think there are a lot of communities. I know Sisters is looking at decoupling their downtown because there's traffic queues in downtown Sisters. And do you want to actually rip apart a vibrant community to move vehicles quicker through there? I think that's a question that I hope that the legislature and other folks can ponder in the future. I already alluded to tourism, but in my meeting this morning with Representative Broom, we talked a little bit about Sun River, and the fact that you can arrive to a place like Sun River, park your car, and never leave and never get in your car again for the weekend. And that actually feels good, that people go there for that reason. They enjoy that. And that's why people visit throughout Oregon. They visit those types of communities. They tend to not visit the community that doesn't have a feel to that they could walk around. There are a number of communities in Oregon that have great tourist destinations, I think, for those reasons. And then health of citizens, and this really links to one of our legislative priorities this time, which is a safe routes to schools issue. But in 1970, about two-thirds of children were walking and biking to school, and you could think back to whether or not that was something you did or maybe your children did. Today, it's less than 20%. And there are health implications that are going along with that. The health department, I think it was a 2000 study, said that about 28% of eighth graders are overweight. And it's just, it's a problem that we continue to face. And over 65% of Oregon adults are as well. There's additional studies that have shown the direct connection between transportation and health. And I think that people who can walk up the stairs instead of choose the elevator, or walk to their store instead of choose a quarter mile instead of choose a car, could actually get added health benefits. And finally, I believe that we represent other people who have a minority interest, like the elders and disabled folks who are using paratransit, or folks who can't afford their own vehicle. And or perhaps they can afford one vehicle, but they can't afford three for the entire household. So I'm trying to paint the picture that this is an important issue, that while it might not be, and I drove down here today, and I drive down here every time I come down here. I haven't biked yet, and maybe I will one time. And I understand there's a variety of needs throughout Oregon, but I think this is an important one, and I hope this is something that can be addressed. Finally, I want to just mention the Oregon Transportation Plan, which is being looked at. I'm sure you've heard a lot about that and will continue. But the Oregon Transportation Plan, right in the front of the draft document, when it says, what is the Oregon Transportation Plan, there are two sentences that I enjoyed. One is, the Oregon Transportation Plan adopted in 1992 is the state's 20-year multimodal plan for the statewide transportation system. The plan includes policies for public transportation, highways, bicycles and pedestrian facilities, waterways, airports, and railroads. However, in the start of that plan and in the development of the citizen committees or the advisory committees, neither of the organizations I represent were even approached. And it seems a little odd to me that bicycles and pedestrian facilities is highlighted right behind public transportation and highways. However, we were not asked to actually enter the formal side of the process, the real influential side of the process. And that might be because we don't have a very well-funded advocacy effort, and maybe in 100 years we will, or it might be for other priorities out there. So I understand that as a committee, you all have and as a legislative assembly, have a very tough job, and I hope that this session in the future you consider to represent some of the interests, the minority, and the important transportation interests that I represent, and things that we are all doing every single day, and actually think about that as you travel around Oregon. So I conclude my remarks and happy to take any questions. Thanks.
Thanks, Scott. Questions?
Thanks for the opportunity.
Okay, railroad short lines. Ken Armstrong, and you've got a couple friends with you.
I do.
Mr. Chair, members, Ken Armstrong representing here today. Last time I was before you, I was talking about ports. Now I'm here to talk about short line railroads. A little bit earlier today, I decided it might be time might be better spent giving you some useful information, so I brought some other people with me. I've got from the Oregon Short Line Railroad Association, Mr. Larry Phipps and Mr. Dan Lovelady, and I'm not going to take any more of your time. I'm going to let them tell you a little bit about their railroads and the role of the short lines in the freight transportation system, and talk a little bit about some of our priorities. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Larry Phipps. I'm with the Portland and Western Railroad. We hear a lot these days about the short line railroads, and many of us simply remember short line from the spot on the monopoly board. So let me tell you about the short lines. They had their genesis in the late 80s, early 90s. For the most part, they were abandonment candidates, spin-off branch lines that came off of the large Class 1 railroads. The short lines had some inherent advantages in operating a smaller railroad that engaged in the gathering and distribution services. So the short line railroads, we go out to the local mills on, for the most part within Oregon, on the branch lines, and we gather and distribute the freight. Then we take it back to the railhead and we give it to the Class 1 carriers, to either the Union Pacific or to the BNSF. We give it to them at the railhead, and it's a pre-blocked train ready to go to Hinkle, or ready to go to Roseville, California, or for furtherance to other points. The short line railroads, when they were formed, they were, as I said, they were a lot of times they were abandonment candidates. Today they have 75-pound rail that was entirely appropriate for even a 70-ton car 20, 30 years ago. Today we're moving 110-ton cars, and some of that 75-pound rail that was rolled in the 1901, 1905, it's just not appropriate for today's loads. So the short lines have quite a need for infrastructure improvement. Today we'd like to tell you about Mr. Lovelady's short line, the Central Oregon and Pacific, and then come back and tell you about some of the other short lines that serve the state, who our big customers are, and go over with you some of the indicators of success in terms of growth of short lines, both in number of carloads and in miles served. So with that, I'd like to introduce Dan Lovelady.
Mr. Chair, committee members, my name's Dan Lovelady. I'm general manager of the Central Oregon and Pacific Railroad. We operate a 439-mile short line railroad that runs from Weed, California to Eugene, Oregon. And then we also operate from Eugene, Oregon, down the coast to Coos Bay and on down to Coquille. We serve more than 75 customers at 100 locations. We interchange traffic with the Union Pacific Railroad at both Weed, California and Eugene, Oregon. We also interchange with the Wairika Western Short Line Railroad in Montague, California, the White City Terminal Railroad in White City, and with Larry's Railroad, the Portland and Western Short Line in Eugene. 85% of the traffic that we handle is related to forest products. And on your Central Oregon and Pacific handout, there's a map of our railroad on the inside cover. We purchased our railroad from the Southern Pacific Railroad in 1994, and we've just had our 10-year anniversary. During our first year of operation, we handled 32,000 revenue carloads of traffic, and we had fewer than 70 employees. Our plan in 2005 is to handle 52,000 revenue carloads, so you can see the growth of our railroad. We have over 112 employees. The 52,000 revenue carloads equates to over 160,000 trucks that aren't on our local roads or on our interstates in Oregon. With this growth, we've had a very difficult time being able to manage the growth with our track structure that we currently have in place. We find it very difficult to handle the growth that we've had. We provide service to several of the area's largest employers, Roseburg Forest Products, Weyerhaeuser, Georgia Pacific, Boise Cascade, Timber Products Company, Douglas County Forest Products, Swanson Superior Forest Products, and several others, many others. Our headquarters are in Roseburg, Oregon. We currently have 112 employees and 27 locomotives, and we have terminals in Weed, California, Medford, Oregon, Roseburg, Oregon, Eugene, Oregon, and in Coos Bay. Despite all of our accomplishments and our growth, we continue to be challenged by a track infrastructure that's over 130 years old and was left neglected by our predecessor, the Southern Pacific. On our railroad, we have 20 tunnels, 450 bridges, and worn-out rail. Since 1995, we've invested nearly $20 million in new ties, in rail, in bridge repairs, and surfacing to improve our physical plant. Yet 75% of our railroad we can only run at 25 miles an hour, and the remainder of our railroad is still 10 miles an hour. On November 3rd of 2003, we experienced a fire at our Tunnel 13, which is just on the Oregon side of the California border. This tunnel is a 3,100-foot-long tunnel. The entire thing burned and caved in and cut off the south end of our railroad and our customers' abilities to reach markets in California and Oregon through our southern interchange at Weed, California. That forced us to take all that traffic north to Eugene, Oregon, through a very congested UP yard in Eugene, and track going south of Eugene. We've spent nearly $14 million repairing this tunnel without any help from a state or federal, or any state or federal assistance. We still don't have the tunnel open after almost 15 months, but we are getting close. We're about 88 feet from seeing daylight, and then we have to put all new track in. So we expect to be back in service delivering traffic down to our south interchange about March 14th. The unexpected tunnel expenses, along with our worn-out infrastructure and several expensive derailments that we had this year, has exhausted our capital, and it's made it very difficult to maintain the service levels needed to attract new customers and to keep our current customers competitive. Oregon's 19 short line railroads need help to make the capital investments required to maintain and rebuild rail services between rural and urban areas. Oregon's short line railroads keep Oregon industry connected to the national rail network, and we are the only alternative to truck traffic on local roads and highways. Many of these short line railroads, as Larry mentioned, were light density branch lines owned by the larger railroads, and they couldn't operate them efficiently, and they made very little investment in these lines, so they were eventually sold off as short lines rather than being abandoned. Today, the local service we provide is threatened due to the introduction of the new heavier, larger cars, which we call 286s, which means 286,000-pound cars. Typically, before the introduction of the bigger cars, the heavier cars were 263,000 pounds. Because we interchange with the Class 1 railroads, we are forced to take these cars or not have any rail traffic, because those are the kind of cars that they're making the standard in the industry. On our railroad, we handle about 75% of our cars are the 286,000. This places an added strain on our track and on our bridge structures, and it makes rehabilitation of our tracks even more urgent. Senate Bill 71 addresses an urgent need to improve both publicly and privately owned transportation infrastructure and to provide economic development in Oregon. Your support of this legislation is critical to attracting new industry and additional jobs in Oregon and in preserving the short line railroads in Oregon. Thanks.
Thank you.
If I could tell you just a little bit about some of the other short lines. Our short lines range from less than 2 miles to over 500 miles. We have the railroad, the Peninsula Terminal, just east of Rivergate. That's 1.9 miles and does 2,700 carloads of freight business. Most all of you within your districts have a short line. The Albany and Eastern runs from Albany to Lebanon, Sweet Home, Mill City, serves Weyerhaeuser, Ferris, Frank Lumber. The Oregon Pacific runs to Molalla and down past OMSI here in Portland. Has 14 miles and does 1,000 carloads. The railroad that I work for has 520 miles of railroad. We do about 93,000 carloads, and we go to Toledo, to the Georgia Pacifics. We go to McMinnville, to Cascade Steel, to Willamina, to Hampton Lumber, to Newburgh, SP Newsprint, to Stempson, and along the Astoria line. We operate the line to Astoria, serve U.S. Gypsum and Tiemann Brothers Logs. The logs are an interesting case. We have begun a movement between my railroad and the Central Oregon and Pacific to move logs, which were lost to the railroads years ago, on rail. We generate about 28 cars a day near Rainier, and take those logs and give them to the Central Oregon Pacific at Eugene, and they take them to the mills in the Siskiyou and Southern Oregon area. We think we have maybe 5% of that market, and each one of those carloads of logs, and we move about 600 or 700 a month. Each of those carloads of logs is 4 or 5 log trucks that we are proud to have displaced from Interstate 5 and from the local roads. We have the Port of Tillamook Bay Railroad that serves Hampton and Stimson at Tillamook and connects with our railroad at Banks. We have the Willamette Valley that goes to Woodburn and State and then serves the canneries there and has a potential for a passenger excursion train. One interesting short line is the Mount Hood Railroad. They only do 92 cars of freight, but they do almost $2 million in passenger revenue. In addition to the passenger revenue, it's tourists that come into the Mount Hood area to ride the dinner train. In eastern Oregon, there's the Idaho Northern that connects La Grande to just Enterprise and St. Joe. There's the Blue Mountain that serves Smith Foods in the northern part of the state, and a new railroad to Wallowa County. As testimony to the success of the short lines, I point out the chart that shows in 1986 we accounted for 8% of the state's rail mileage, and today we account for 52% of the state's railroad mileage. We do virtually all of the gathering and distribution within the state. Another one that, as testimony to the success of the short line model, is the carloads. We've gone since 1993 from 44,000 carloads today to over 178,000 carloads of freight that we generate. The importance of generating that freight is that that's mill direct shipments, because with the short line, you continue to have the rail service into the remote parts of the state, and you're not depending upon trucks on the highway 22s and 26s and the like of the world. One last thing that I'll point out that is another potential for short lines, because you have the infrastructure, you have the right of way ready made, is the potential for commuter service and for other passenger service. We have a project going with Washington County and TriMet to run commuter service from Wilsonville to Beaverton. It's only 15 and a half miles, but you just heard that to put another lane on 217 is $400 million. And we will run parallel to 217 for a good part of that distance. The other thing in just looking at the maps is you see the railroad lines that go through Newburgh and McMinnville and into Portland from Lake Oswego. You see the line that goes down as far as Wilsonville, and what an easy step it would be to continue on to Salem. So we think that the short line railroads have great opportunities with the state. In the past two legislative sessions, there were bills that were passed that provided in each of those two sessions $2 million for short line infrastructure. Those $2 million in both cases leveraged over $5 million in investment in short line infrastructure. So when we look at the Connect Oregon and you look at the role that the rails play, you look at the role that the short lines play in gathering that freight and taking it to the railheads, we think that short lines are an important part of Oregon's transportation infrastructure. So if you have any questions, we'd be pleased to address them. Otherwise, thank you for having us here and for your time.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, thank you. And I apologize, Mr. Chairman, for being late. I had another committee hearing on a bill that I sponsored. But this is very interesting to me, obviously, with the Prineville short line in Central Oregon. And I've got the Oregon Trunk Line. It runs right through my district, the city of Bend. This is important. I've spent a lot of time in the last week or so visiting with the mayor about some of these rail issues, Act 3 crossings and those types of things, and a spur route on the Juniper Ridge property on the north side of town. But I'm particularly interested in your comment about the 286s and the requirement to use them, and I presume you've been using them now for some time, a year or two perhaps?
More than that.
Yeah, they really started coming around probably becoming a major part of the car market, I would say mid-90s. So there are some of the lighter branch lines that we own, for example, that aren't yet capable. The bridges and the 75-pound rail, not yet capable. But where we have the heavier rail, we run the 286s.
And so where you can't handle the 286s, does that mean you have to do reloads instead of just swapping?
Well, the problem with that is that your customer, the shipper, is a disadvantage because he's selling lumber in a 70-ton car and competing with people that are selling lumber in 286 cars.
Right.
So it places them at a competitive disadvantage.
So, Mr. Chairman,
yes.
Thank you. So you had talked about the $2 million and the leveraging and that and supporting SB 71, but I'm curious, do you have some sort of a ballpark cost estimate on what it'd take to get these short lines up to grade to handle this and be competitive and help our businesses?
Well, I would take a stab. I would say that in the last that for the most part we invest about $4 million in a year to sort of keep our railroad where it is. Dan indicated they've spent about $23 million in the last 8-9 years. So I would think order of magnitude, if you replace the light rail with heavier rail, it probably runs somewhere in the neighborhood of $200,000 a mile. So where you have the 75-pound rail, and you have the car volume to justify it, and you have the need for those heavier cars, getting rid of that rail is usually about $200,000 a mile. We just did last year with a grant from the state of Oregon. We had a $294,000 grant, and with that, we leveraged our funds, the customer's funds, Hampton Lumber, and the UP's contribution of rail, and we laid 10 miles of rail, about a $2 million project for the $294,000. So I think that is one thing that in all of these things, I think that the leverage is a key part. And oftentimes where the short line operator might not be able to fund it himself, in many cases, the grant funds are enough to create a lot of leverage.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Burley, if I might, Ken Armstrong again, we can work with the rail division within ODOT to see if we can get a better sense of what the magnitude is of the specific question. You know, X number of miles, X dollars to be able to bring everything up to the 286 standard.
Great. Good. Other questions?
I guess I just would like to thank you for your presentations, by the way. I just need to clarify in my mind. I understand how highways and bridges, you know, we have a multitude of users, different kinds of users, and I know how they're funded. Now, how are you are a private, these are privately owned, and how are they currently, I mean, how do you charge your customer? Are you in essence competing with haulers, truck haulers, and are you charging enough? It sounds like maybe you're not. I don't know. I'm just
there are two that aren't privately owned. One is the Lake County that runs from Lake County down to Alturas. It's owned by the county, and the other is the Wallawa Union. It's recently formed by the county. Most of the short lines, when they were created, you entered a contract that provided for a set rate for you to handle that freight. And that's how most of them are structured. It's a contractual rate that we get so much per carload for the most part.
Contractual rate with like SP Newsprint and
the no with the Union Pacific with and BNSF.
I see. Okay.
Yes.
I'm sure I had something else, but
and I understand where you're going with some of that stuff, and I can follow up with you too, Representative, if you like. We can have a little bit more detailed discussion about some of those issues.
Thank you.
Oh, yes, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Kind of the flip side, to some degree, of Representative Thatcher's question is maybe some sense of comparison of where we are with other states in terms of what other states, like the state of Washington, for instance, how much they've invested in short lines compared to the investment that we've made. At some degree, that kind of the two answers to those give a sense of where we are.
Without the specific numbers, I can tell you it's order of magnitude tenfold, minimum tenfold with Washington, for example, because they are catching up very quickly. A lot of the eastern states have significant short line programs, but here in the west, Washington has really been active in the past few years.
Further questions?
Well, just to make sure, the users of these lines are all businesses for the most part, except for maybe even the passenger, the Mount Hood Dinner Rail, that's a private business as well. Okay, thank you.
Correct.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Appreciate your time.
Thank you. And we'll follow up with some of those questions. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a reminder, we have a joint session with the Senate Transportation Committee at 3 o'clock on rail. I think it's nation. Freight rail. So right here.
No.
Oh, and 50. In room 50. That's right. Downstairs. It's not required that you all be there, but we'd like as many of you attend as possible. Anything further to come before the meeting? Committee. Meeting adjourned. Thank you.